Hi everyone, and welcome to the Existential Delight podcast. My name is Dylan, and in this episode I speak with Father John Brown, SJ. He is a Jesuit priest and also the president of the Jesuit High School of New Orleans. This was a very interesting conversation because we speak about the controversy surrounding the Jesuits, as well as the liturgy wars and the different generational approaches to Catholicism and traditionalism. Overall, I think the conversation is very uplifting and encouraging, and just a conversation that I really enjoyed. Father John has been commenting on my videos for some time, and so I thought it would be great to have a conversation with him. So I reached out, and
unfortunately, we did experience some technical difficulties during the conversation. So if there are some seemingly abrupt cuts at certain points during the talk, I think it only happens about two or three times,
then just know that that was when technical difficulties hit us. But I did my best to make those transitions seem as smooth as possible. So hopefully it's not too much of a problem. But anyway, without further ado, here is my conversation with Father John Brown. Speaking of not maybe your other job, but your vocation, let me ask it this way. What's it like being a priest?
I'm coming up on the mark where I've been a priest for almost half my life. So it's sort of like asking a fish, what's it like to swim in water, you know? I will say this, it's great that every single day I'm availing myself, you know, to the sacraments, which is fantastic. The prayer is probably the biggest change, right? So praying the office every day. So five times a day, there are these sort of liturgical ways of praying that really shape my mental vocabulary, right? Really shape my mental vocabulary in a way that I did not know was possible, you know. Maybe before I became a Jesuit, a lot of what I imagined sort of being deep into religion, it was a much more intellectual exercise. So the more facts that you know. the farther along you are. And instead, what I found is the more it's transformed me in the way that I think, the way that I engage, all those sorts of things. And then, of course, being a Jesuit, that vow of obedience also has a major effect on what I'm going to do, you know. So I can't choose to leave my job and go pursue something else. I can't choose where I'm going to work, what I'm going to do, or anything like that. And that frees me up to be able to give everything that I have to the job that I'm in, which I happen to love, right? It's sort of funny how the love sort of follows the obedience, if that makes sense, you know. Instead of saying, I love this thing and I'm going to choose it, instead I'm choosing to say yes to an assignment, and then, you know, I pretty quickly fall in love with what I'm asked to do. And that's probably the biggest mark of the life that I'm living now.
And as a convert, which is, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but I don't really like to categorize myself just as a convert, because I think it I think I'm as much a Catholic as any cradle Catholic, really,
of course,
at the end of the day, right?
Yeah.
But as a convert, I do have a slightly different perspective on the orders, because when I was coming into the church, I came in at a really interesting time. Like, I think there's something now going on called the liturgy wars, where there seems to be this kind of tension between traditionalism and everything else. And I've noticed that Jesuits seem to get a lot of flack. And I remember my deacon at my local church here in Pretoria, he told me this joke. He loves the Jesuits. But he told me this joke, something like, the Dominican order was founded to stop the spread of a specific heresy, and the Jesuits were founded to stop the spread of Protestantism, but the Protestants are still here. Something like this, kind of like tongue in cheek. Teasing of the Jesuits. And
sure,
what do you make of that as a Jesuit? Like,
well, so there are many levels to this, right? Many layers to this. I think on the surface, look, everybody teases everybody. It's funny. I laugh at the jokes. A lot of times they can be really funny, and I'm going to laugh at them. I tell them myself. I tell the jokes myself. The unfortunate part of all this is that I think deep inside the human heart, is a desire to understand and to, in some sense, control things by understanding them, right? And you know, you see this in, with conspiracy theorists very often. Once they know that it's the Illuminati, that they're taking over the world, now I see what they're doing. And in seeing it, they feel more powerful. They've got some control back out of the narrative. They're not just being, you know, sort of dragged along through the whole thing. And so I think the very same thing in the church happens, where if somebody can say, I think I understand where the church went wrong. I think I understand how this is, why it's broken, how it got broken, all that kind of stuff. And so a common narrative is the progressives have ruined the church. And, you know, at the tip of the spear of the progressive movement have been the Jesuits. Therefore, the Jesuits are awful. Right. And so we're no longer making fun. We're no longer joking at that point. We are. Yeah. We're feeling like we got a grip on everything that's wrong in the world.
Yes.
And so it's so unfortunate. There are over 16,000 Jesuits worldwide.
Wow.
many of them are Jesuits who are celebrating the traditional Latin Mass every day, you know, writing all the best articles, doing all the best things that any very staunch conservative would love. And then on the other side, you've got some Jesuits who make headlines for saying things that are out of line with the church teaching, or at least difficult to reconcile with the church teaches. And so I think it's unfortunate that stereotype sort of settles in people's minds to the point where they might miss out on all the good things that Jesuits might do or say or anything. And it even, I think, approaches the point of sinfulness, where it's sort of like it's akin to a deep prejudice that people have, where they judge something before they know anything about it, and judge people before they know anything about them. And it's, you know, this is part of what it means to be human. Now, I don't lose a lot of sleep over it, but that's there.
Well, I think that's a good assessment. You know, I've been thinking about this a lot, and let me just say a few things. First of all, YouTube is an American company, so I don't think anybody would disagree with that. Meaning the majority of people that use YouTube are going to be Americans. Meaning the majority of conversations on YouTube are going to be experiences shared by Americans. So I can kind of see this from the outside, not being an American, not living in America, not being exposed to the daily politics you guys are going through. And what I see as an outsider is there's a conflation, there's almost a mixing between kind of church ideas and church movements. And there's a conflation of that with American political ideology at the moment. So the church will say something like, we should look after the environment. Now, that's true. I love the park. I love I live in Africa. Right. I love the bushveld. I love going and looking at wild animals, and I love the idea of looking after and, you know, stopping the government from moving in and building a shopping mall over a beautiful natural stream. Like, who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't want to conserve that? And funny enough, Gen Z, especially here in South Africa, are very conservative in that sense. We want to conserve nature. We want to conserve the environment. But because, and this is again,
you sound like a communist.
Yeah, probably.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but you've clearly raised up your lefty, crazy, your progressive flag now.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think all the grass should be watered equally. In that sense, I guess I'm a communist, you know. Everybody deserves an equal. I should distribute the water to all the plants. And it's like, if the church says something that happens to align with the current left-wing ideology in American politics, that does not mean that the church as a whole is left-wing, right? Or if the church happens to say something that's currently popular among the right-wing within American politics, that does not mean that the church as a whole is a right-wing institution. And that's what I'm, as an outsider, observing a lot.
That's
on the especially the Catholic, and no, it's not just Catholic, it's all domains
that's
of
right
social
that's
conversation right. But I think and now what happens is people enter the church, and I noticed this a lot with my conversion video that I released recently, where I basically laid out how I became Catholic. In the comment section, 90-95% of the comments have been wonderful, just beautiful, kind, loving, from all groups. And then there's like 5% of people who are either like really angry or really miserable about my conversion. And then there's another group of Catholics who are kind of fighting for me to join their side.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm already on your side if you're Catholic.
Right. Right.
You know, like, why do I have to be, why do I have to now label myself as a trad or label myself as a, you know, whatever the opposite of that is, progressive or something. It's like, I agree with the church. And I feel like a lot of people will say, well, I'm Catholic and I'm not left wing or right wing, but then they will kind of expect that they'll expect the church to align with that ideology instead of adjusting themselves to the church. So I used to be pretty, you know, just to finish this off, I used to think that the emphasis on the environment was maybe a little bit silly, to be honest with you, Father. And then I realized, you know what, actually, the church is right. Like, we need to care about the environment. There's nothing wrong with that. And I'm glad, you know, I'm going to quote Chesterton. I don't want a church that tells me I'm right when I think I'm right. I want a church that tells me I'm wrong when I think I'm right.
Right. I think, well, I hate to disappoint you, but I think you're right.
Funny enough, not disappointed, but please continue. Yeah. What do you think of that assessment? Just,
I think you are exactly on the nose, right? So the first time I left the United States and was in a I went to Mexico, and I learned that in Mexico the divisions aren't the same, right? So you have these sort of liberation theology guys who are very excited about the sort of that they're going to, you know, develop a plan that's going to lead the poor out of poverty. And in that sense, it kind of echoes upwards to the United States, right? And in the sense of go northwards to the United States, that a lot of more progressive Catholics in the United States sort of hear that language coming from poorer countries. They feel quite a bit of guilt because, you know, in the United States we are affluent and we don't suffer a lot, you know, from poverty. At least not in comparison to what you'll see in some of the Latin America, and. So that part lined up, and I just immediately assumed everything else would with a group of Jesuits. I just assumed everything else would, and found out that no, these guys were as pro-life as could be. These guys were their own sense of embracing poverty was incredible, and it was inspirational. At the same time, there was a lack of closeness to the people in terms of prayer that I found. Like I'm just talking about the divisions, the left and right divisions, where a lot of the Jesuits there were coming from Spain, and they came in with very strong political ideas. And then you talk to the average sort of church going Mexican, and these people just wanted somebody to help them, you know, say their prayers when somebody died, and you know, and it just I was watching the whole dynamic. Line issues up in very different places.
Yeah.
And that has gotten me not only to sort of re-examine those kind of things and those divisions and realize how false they are, but also to watch, for example, to watch Pope Francis. He is not thinking in line with those the sort of two-party system that we have in the United States. He doesn't conceive of the world that way.
Yes.
And often when you hear him say one thing, you assume all these other things about him, which just aren't true. I mean, I'm not saying that he's a right-wing American, you know, but he's definitely not in the same, he can't be categorized the way that we might want to categorize him. And again, it's this desire to believe that you can control something by understanding and knowing it and knowing the facts. And then you feel better about, even if you're on the losing side, you can still say, I know how this works. And unfortunate, it's just not true. It's unfortunate, but it's just not true.
Yeah. I mean, the whole Pope Francis dialogue online, it's almost gotten to the point now where there are certain pages that you just know by the name of that channel whether they're going to interpret Francis in the most uncharitable way, or they're going to interpret him in the most charitable way, or you're going to get a kind of balanced view. But generally, I find it's not all three. It's generally one of the two. It's either very uncharitably, or it's sort of in the middle, but leaning towards charity. But I also think I think a lot of the debates, especially between, and I'm very happy to be wrong on this, but I think a lot of the debates online a lot of it is happening between converts, in my experience. I don't think it's cradle Catholics getting on. I think it's like guys who've converted. A lot of the ortho bros who are angry at me for being Catholic, I find a lot of them were Protestants who already hated the Pope. Yeah. And right. then orthodoxy right. kind of really appeals to them. Now, that's not the case for right. all of them. And there's wonderful orthodox commentators. There's a lot of wonderful like orthodox dialogue, and I've learned a lot of from orthodoxy. I don't agree with mm-hmm. orthodoxy ultimately at the end of the day. There's a reason I'm Catholic. Right. But the kind of vitriol online is just, I think it's a kind of symptom of the internet rather than a symptom of the people themselves who hold those beliefs.
Yeah. So I hope you're right. Well, number one, I appreciate the zeal on the part of anybody who really believes what they believe. I really do appreciate that zeal. And I appreciate it when the zeal is aimed at sort of like if I care about you, I'm going to want you to think all the right things. If I believe that I'm thinking the right things, I'm going to want you to think like I do. Yeah. And the more, you know, so in some sense, there's a place for some of that zeal.
Yeah.
And I think that that can be good. I think that a lot of these, you know, a lot of the converts that you meet are very zealous. They go to church, you know? And so, you know, I know a whole lot of cradle Catholics who do not go to church. They'll tell you that they are Catholic. And what they mean is they're sort of like ethnically Catholic, like, well, hey, my parents were Catholic. And so I'm Catholic more or less, you know, or something like that. And in America, we often call them the cafeteria Catholics. They sort of take the parts of Catholicism that they like and leave the rest behind. And they feel like they're satisfied with what they've taken, that sort of thing. And so you know, when I have to choose between the two, I'm not so sure that the very zealous, you know, ortho bros are completely wrong. You know, if I had to choose one or the other, you know, I do think there's something to what you said about a lot of people who've converted to one thing or another. When they made their choice, it was in distinction to something else. Right. So they chose orthodoxy, for example, apart from Catholicism, even though Catholicism is in the United States, at least we have Catholic churches, multiple Catholic churches in every small town, you know, it's hard to get away from Catholicism and it's hard to find an Orthodox church. So when someone chose an orthodoxy, they've chosen a hard path for themselves. And so they're going to need to defend that decision.
Yeah.
And sometimes they chose that harder path because they were raised with a very anti-Catholic bias. And I find this with a lot of the clergy. So a lot of times the clergy, a lot of their introduction to the theology in general, it's like they're armored up against anything that the Catholic Church is going to say about the Pope. And so now they've been convinced of all these other things that they would share in common with Catholicism. And so what they'll do is they'll say, it's definitely not the Catholics. It's definitely not them. But even the stuff that we share in common, we as Orthodox do it better than the Catholics, you know, and I'm sure there are many cases where that might be true, but it's unfortunate because I don't find these people in real life. I don't find anyone so you know, with their dukes up quite so much in real life, but on the internet, they're able to do that.
Yeah. And I mean, someone might be watching this and getting mad at me for maybe seeming to throw the Orthodox under the bus, but that's not at all what I'm trying to do. I'm actually kind of trying to figure out, are we just going to be in this kind of limbo for the next, or purgatory, I should say, for the next, you know.
I don't know if you want to say purgatory.
Yeah, they
don't
maybe not purgatory. Oh, yeah, well. Insert appropriate theological term here. Are we going to be in this thing for the next 20, 30, 40 years online? I'm just curious how the dialogue is going to develop, right? Like, are we still in 40 years going to be, I don't know what things will be like at that point, but are we still going to be logging into social conversations and have like a group of guys who are using the same arguments we're using today against Catholicism? I'm sure those arguments will always be around, but is that anger always going to be there? Because I feel like I'm just always trying to think of a way forward. Like, what can we do? If not even to agree with each other, how can we show the rest of the world, which we're trying to save, how can we show them that despite our differences, we still have unity in some sense, right? And so that's kind of why I raise this question. I don't raise it to make Catholics look amazing and make Orthodox look bad. That's not at all the case. And I think very oftentimes, you know, it's everybody's got, there's problems on all sides, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly for my own part, I'm trying to learn everything that I can. What I'm finding is, and this I may change my mind about this in 6 months, who knows? But what I'm currently finding is that the more I learn about Orthodoxy, the more I the stronger my opinion becomes that the real division here is happening on a different plane of existence. Right? The leadership in the churches have firmed up their divisions and reasons why this just can't work. But that when it comes to Christian brotherhood, I think at the lower levels, we can, in a sense, heal the schism in a real serious way by learning from each other. And here's something I've found out, and you know, maybe people won't want to hear this, but when I was in Iraq, I went to Iraq for a while, and the Christians there are under serious persecution, right? I mean, there are Christians dying, right? There are Christians dying, and they went from, you know, millions of Christians in the Nineveh Plains down to, you know, the low hundreds of thousands, right? Yeah. Just completely destroyed. And the Orthodox and the Catholics, and there are Eastern Catholics there, all worship together. It's very hard to find the distinction there, right? And I remember being shocked by that, but also deeply consoled that when it comes down to it, the Christians there have all decided that it is a real scandal that there are divisions. And so they you know, if you ask a Muslim, the Muslims in Iraq will tell you, oh, all those Christians are all the same. And so for us, it's like, oh, you know, we might know that there are real divisions there, but we don't act like it. And that's I found that to be a very consoling thing. And I'm sure there are theological problems with this, but it was very consoling. I saw this in Ireland as well. Really? And I bristled a little bit in Northern Ireland that there are, you know, Anglicans and Catholics worshiping together in a way that I did not think was okay. And yet they've said, look, we have we're in a very dire situation, and we're not going to let the theologians and the sort of leadership in the church that want to really get down to those fine distinctions. We're not going to let them keep us apart as Christians, and they will know that we are Christians by our love. And that means our love for each other at the very least. And again, I'm not saying, you know, hey, let's all just be, you know, the ecumenism's great. No problems with it. No, I recognize all those things. But it is beautiful to see sometimes when Christians are really and truly persecuted, that drives us together.
Yeah.
I think that's a beautiful thing.
Okay. So what you just said about the persecution bringing Christians together, it's almost like it's a luxury that we can argue about our differences. I think once you strip away all of the basics, it almost kind of makes me think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Like at the base level, mm-hmm. you have Christ, and then as you ascend, you get into the more minutiae of details, which are all equally important. Like psychological health is also as important as basic health in the bigger scheme of things, just as liturgical elements or the smaller details are just as important as your relationship with Christ. But fundamentally, if you strip away all those other elements, the thing that unites each Christian, the base of our hierarchy of needs is Christ. I think that's one, maybe a way of thinking about it.
Right. I think you're right. I think maybe, I don't know if I'd even go so far as to say that those things are just as important. I would say they're just as true, but not necessarily as important. So the way I often think about it is this: if I, you know, pulled out a set of car keys and I tossed them to you and you were to catch those car keys, right? You're not doing the physics. You're definitely not doing particle physics. You know, you're definitely not drilling down to that level. You're just dealing with what's in front of you. And so I believe that my hope is in that, in the same way that persecution in the Middle East of Christians in the Middle East, my same sense is that, or my hope is that Orthodox and Catholics recognize the way in which we are being persecuted by the culture. Right. There's a culture which is embracing meaninglessness as a virtue. It's embracing a very poor version of French existentialism, you know, and it's a real crisis. Yeah. And souls are being lost. Right. Souls are being lost. And so my hope is that every Catholic, and I hope the Catholics, I hope there's a real unity amongst Catholics in the same way, that we recognize that we really are being persecuted in a very sneaky way. The devil is sneaky, and we are being persecuted in the very same way, and souls are at stake, and we need to all recognize that and get along.
Yeah, well said. Maybe on this note, we could move into something else I wanted to talk to you about, which is just your general background. I think I would be remiss if I didn't ask you if you always knew if you wanted to be a priest, or if it was something that kind of, was it difficult for you to make that decision, or how did it come about? What led up to that, and what kind of had you realizing this was what you wanted to do?
Sure. Yeah. You know, when I was just a little bitty kid, I mean like 5 or 6 years old, I remember going to Mass with my family, and I had memorized the words of Mass, and wow. I thought it was I could say along with the priest all of his parts, you know. And at some point I remember looking at the priest and thinking, why is that man wearing a dress? And I think that priests need to start wearing pants, you know. in my mind, I just got turned off by the whole thing, and it's a shame. But I come from a part of the United States where the whole sexual abuse crisis became painfully clear when I was young, and so I was raised in a household that was very pious, but did not have an automatic love for priests. And so I certainly lost any thought that I might become a priest from the time I was 5 until the time I was in my early 20s, when about 23 years old, I felt a certain meaningless in my life. Like it was more coming from. So I was a graphic designer, project manager, website developer kind of guy, and I was traveling a lot. It was right when the internet felt like it was brand new. So late 90s. And it was very exciting. All the things I thought I would have wanted. I came from a very small town, from a farm outside of a small town. And so I was living in this big city of Houston, Texas, and everything was so fast. And, you know, the girls were so pretty and all this kind of stuff, you know, and there was just a meaninglessness there emptiness there that prompted me to begin to pray more seriously, asking God, well, what do you want me to do? I'm sure you don't want me to become a priest, but I'll do all these other things, whatever else you want me to do, I'll do. And then eventually I found myself telling God, look, if you want me to be a priest, I would do it. And then to my surprise, I felt a response from God tugging at my heart to do this. So I did not want to do it. I did not calculate that it would be a good thing for me. I did not calculate that I would be a good priest. I did not think, I've got all the skills. I've got everything it takes to be a good priest. I didn't think that at all, which is sort of why I joined the Jesuits. I knew that the Jesuits did so many different things. They would find some place to plug me in where I could be helpful. And I knew their formation was long. And so I knew that they would give me plenty of time for me to catch up with whatever it is that I needed to learn. Yeah. And I also very impressed with the spirituality of St. Ignatius Loyola, very impressed with the Jesuit saints. And so I ended up joining the Jesuits in the year 2000. Wow. And I've found, as it turned out, you know, God knew me better than I knew myself. And so I found out that it's actually a great place to be and a great vocation to have.
Wow. What was your first Mass like when you said your first Mass?
I had a 7 or 8 priests right next to me doing everything, you know, like pointing in the book where to say what words and everything like that. So I was ordained in New Orleans in a great big church with the bishop and all that. And then I immediately drove. As it turns out, I'm from South Louisiana. I live and work here now. Most Jesuits live and work in places other than where they grew up. But I grew up about 2.5 hours away from where I live now. So I was able to drive back to the place where I was raised and go to my home parish and say a Mass in front of all the hometown people. And so it was great. It was a relief, right? So that's after, you know, just about 11 years as a Jesuit before they ordained me. And so, it's a long time to wait until you can actually celebrate Mass for yourself, you know?
What was the response like from your family and your friends? Was it kind of out of the blue?
Nobody thought I was going to be a good priest. Like nobody expected that to happen. And I don't blame them. I really don't blame them. I remember, you know, my mother's response was, when I told her, I said, I think I'm supposed to be a priest. My mother's response was, this is a terrible thing. And my mother passed away not that long ago. So I don't mean to speak ill of her,
sorry to
but
hear that.
She said, don't you know that the priesthood is a haven for homosexuals and child molesters? And wow. It was like, like that was from somebody who went to mass every Sunday and who prayed every day and who totally believes all the things. You know, her thought was not the priesthood, you know.
Wow.
And then after knowing me, like, my mother had known me to be dating girls and you know, living all the regular life of a young man in the United States. And so her thought was, this is awful. What in the world would make you want to do this? Wow. And it did not take long for her to see the real joy and the way in which my heart was responding to being obedient to God, that everyone changed their minds not long after I began, I think. But at first nobody thought, it was like, you're not going to do this for long. This can't be for you. Something's wrong with you right now. You'll get over it and come back, you know?
Yeah.
But it's turned out to be the opposite. I think everybody sees now why it's a good fit.
Yeah. And it's a great witness as well to the Catholic faith. Every day that you continue to do it, it kind of shows people how God can change people. I saw something this morning where somebody was asking someone what convinced you of Christ, and then they asked him, was it a miracle or something that happened in your life? And he said, I wouldn't call it a miracle, but God changed me. And that was more convincing than if I had seen something bizarre happen,
right?
Because like I knew myself better than I know anything else, really. So to see myself change and to look in the mirror and feel a different emotion when I look at myself, not feel guilt or shame or disappointment, but to look at myself and think, wow, I'm actually kind of proud of how I behaved yesterday. Like, I was kind and I don't feel terrible. And that kind of shift, I think God, you know, you said the devil's sneaky, which I completely agree with. The devil also works sometimes in mysterious ways to us, right? We don't often say that, but we're not cognizant always of the way he's maneuvering. But God is also very sneaky sometimes in a good way. God sometimes changes you and you don't realize you're being changed. And then one day you look back and you go, wow, C.S. Lewis has that great line where he says, day by day, things feel the same. But when you look back, everything is different.
Right.
And that's absolutely been my experience as well, where you might feel really stuck on a sin, like you can't get over it. And then one day you look back and you think, oh, where did that go? Mm-hmm. And was that similar for you in, you know, those feelings of doubt about being a priest? Was it kind of gradual?
I think that it's true that it was gradual. It's also true that it vacillated, you know, sort of like back and forth, that I found myself when interested in something that was improper for my vocation, right? Improper to what God calls me to. I would often find myself having to justify it in my mind, like this can't be a bad thing because, you know, I'm human, or this person deserved to be treated that way, or whatever it was, right? There are a number of ways in which I have not been a great priest, right? And so it's often that I would be convinced, I would have to be convinced, I would have to let myself become convinced that it was a good thing to even allow me to interact with it, with this temptation, whatever it was. And then I would find myself, upon further examination, recognizing, okay, so I went from being tempted by the grossest, worst sins, right? Of which it was hard to resist, but eventually, you know, you sort of build up the kind of fortitude that it takes to resist those things.
Yeah.
To finding that eventually the devil is sneaky, right? He begins to tempt you with things which are second best and not the best, right? And so I find myself attracted to things which are in reality good, that they are in every way good and certainly good enough, but not the best. And I found it was harder and harder for me to live with something that was good and wonderful, but not proper to what God has been calling me to. And and I think that's sort of been the movement, you know. So you know, at first, at first the gross temptations, right? But then eventually tempted by an angel of light that appears to be something good, but really not as good as it could be. And so, you know, again, I don't want to pretend that I'm, you know, perfect now or anything like that, but I live in a world in which I'm always constantly trying to find what is the, what glorifies God the most, and asking God for the grace to be able to choose it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a common criticism of Christians in general is that we're hypocrites, or that we're prideful. You know, once you become a Christian, you start thinking you're better than everybody else. But I felt the opposite experience. I find I'm far more wretched than I thought. I'm not right. Just that, you know, like we're more than just, like a human being is not just at base just sin. Like there's more to us there. There's the capacity to reach for what's holy. But you know, that awareness that you talk about, like just knowing, like the fact that you can kind of look back and say, okay, well, I have these issues and I'm not perfect. And to me, that's psychologically very healthy. I think that's one of the benefits. Well, you know, there's always a risk of psychologizing belief, but that is, right. if you want to talk about it in those terms, it's psychologically very good for you to be able to just acknowledge who you are, because it just ultimately means that you've kind of reached the end goal of self-reflection, which is that you actually see yourself as you are, as if you were right. looking in a mirror of your soul, right? What advice would you give to a convert, maybe who's just recently converted? Because I get the sense that there's a lot of converts on YouTube. As a cradle Catholic yourself, and as a priest, what advice, Father, would you give to just a cradle Catholic entering the church?
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, take whatever got you to become a Catholic and don't lose that. So often that would be, for example, the apologetics, you know, that you know, all the arguments and all that. So don't lose that. But then venture out into some of those areas that the apologetics websites and everything are going to be less likely to get involved in, like develop a devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, right? Develop a devotion to this conceiving of your relationship with God as this constant offering of Jesus saying, here, take my heart and put it in your chest, right? Take my heart and put it in your chest so that you and I can be united, right? I think that this is, you know, look, this is theosis. This is all those things that, you know, I think that's what's at the heart of those kind of things. So we can theologize about all those things, just like we can talk about particle physics whenever somebody's trying to toss us a set of car keys, right? But what really ought to be happening is that we're building that kind of muscle memory to be able to conceive of the world through the lens of the fact that God wants us to be united with Him. And so that changes how you're going to participate in the Mass. That's going to change the way that you're going to pray. That's going to ultimately form you, by the grace of God, into who God has made you to be. And all of the things that get people to convert in the first place have their place. Don't let them go, but venture out into the depths of what we're really doing here. And I think that would be my advice to any Catholic, you know, any convert.
Yeah. I love what you said about building devotions, and you pointed out that, you know, apologetics resources online are not necessarily going to get into that. They can only take you so far. At a certain point, it's going to be 10 o'clock at night. It's going to be quiet outside. You're going to hear the buzzing of insects, and your family's going to be asleep, and you're going to be alone in the living room on your cell phone, and you have a choice. What am I going to do now? And you could read another apologetics article, or you could switch off your phone, be silent and just meditate or pray on the Lord. Right. And it's like those moments, no amount of YouTube videos. I would go so far as to say that 50 hours of watching YouTube videos isn't going to give you the same benefit as just that being willing to open your heart to the Lord in a moment of silence with Him. I don't think we want to put the two against each other. So it's not like I want to put studying, you know, intellectual understanding is, I think, very important. And for a lot of us, if we're so inclined, that's how we deepen our faith. But at the same time, I think you want to go out of your comfort zone, and I think you want to do something that's not what you're used to. And I think you can find a lot of right. benefit.
Right. And recognizing the transformative nature of the faith, right? Mm-hmm. So this is one of those things, not to get on a huge tangent, but this is one of those things that's kept me completely uninterested in psychedelics, is that I see people who've just gone all the way in on those things and not actually transformed into any sort of into what I would hope would happen if they really were that close to the divine. Right. And so it reminds me, I have a saying that a lot of people dislike, but I believe that psychedelics are to spirituality what pornography is to love, you know? So there's a whole lot of overlap. There's a whole lot of the same, you know, you get a whole lot of the same feelings, maybe even, right? You get a whole lot of the same. There are parts of your brain that are going to just get all excited, right? But what's really behind all that, if it's not a God who loves you, who wants to pull you into himself, transforming you the entire time, burning away those parts of you that don't belong. If that's not really there, what you'll get are people who wind up talking more about the psychedelic experience than they do about the God that really calls them. Right. And so, I think that's what we're all really, really after, and that in the end, you wind up having no place for things like pornography in a marriage that's good and going well and the way that it should be, just like you wouldn't have any place for things like psychedelics in a relationship with God, where God is trying to mold you and shape you into a saint, you know?
100% agree. Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. It was shocking to my friends when I became a Christian, especially the friends who are immersed in that world. Just to add on to your point, a very common question I would get was, okay, so you're a Christian now, but are you done with this stuff? Are you? And I remember, and I still do, I don't feel like I need it anymore. I don't want it anymore. There's no, it sounds exactly how you're describing it. I think that's a really a very good insight you had to describe it that way, because it is like pornography to love. It's and the funny thing is that I don't actually think that the psychedelic experience can make you, it can be so convincing that you think that what you're experiencing is truth, and what right. you're ultimately going to experience, and this is widely reported from a lot of people who have it, and people who've had the experience will know what I mean when I say that it dissolves the sense of boundaries. So it dissolves the sense of yourself as an individual in the world. You very much melt into the world around you. There's no distinction anymore between the ego or the feeling of self and the environment that you're observing. In other words, the observer and the observed are experienced as one thing. And I don't actually think that that maps onto what's really happening. I think that the boundaries are there for a reason, which is to me the more interesting question. It's like, why are there boundaries in the first place? Mm-hmm. Why do I feel separate from you? If you and I are just one, okay, well, why in my everyday 24/7 awareness is that not what I experience? That's really the interesting question. Why do I need right. to take a mushroom to get around that experience? And it's exactly what you say. People then venerate the psychedelic, they're obsessed with the mushroom. And I mean, there's even a book called The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, where
right.
Allegro
right.
argues that Jesus was a mushroom. I mean, that's like the most extreme, right? And I have a friend who unironically will affirm that Christ was a mushroom. And I just, actually, the funny thing is, I used to think I was very close to what's really going on, or in other words, I was very close to reality. But now in retrospect, I see that psychedelics actually alienate you from the world around you. They actually pull you into, they actually don't reveal the illusion. I think that they overlay an additional illusion onto your everyday experience that you now right. have to contend with.
Right. At best, it may spark some desire for more, right? So,
yeah.
you know, like I think of, you know, again, I make the comparison to pornography. I'm sure pornography has played a part in awakening a lot of young men to their desire for women, right? And so, it may have played some part for a lot of people, but just because it sparked your interest in the outside doesn't mean that there's not something far more important that the outside can actually become an obstacle to, right?
Yeah.
So, that's what I see.
Yeah, like well, heroin might spark someone's interest in becoming a chemist, but we would never recommend that you try some heroin,
right.
Just to find out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So, I think maybe one kind of last thing we could move into that I want to just explore with you is we're obviously from different generations. I'm far younger. I'm turning 28 this year, so I'm not a teenager. I'm a father. I'm a husband at least, but we are from different generations. So my experience of the current, I personally believe there's a religious reemergence happening. I think we're like in the middle of it. I think a lot of Gen Z and the generation after them, and even millennials, of which I am one, I think we're seeing that emerging now. What's your vantage point like? I think you mentioned once you're Gen X, right?
That's right. Yeah. So I was born in 1975, which puts me kind of at the younger end of the Gen X guys. But I definitely don't. When you list all the things that make someone a millennial, I have a hard time relating to those things. Mm-hmm. So so there's definitely a difference. But I'll tell you that what I have noticed, and this I see it everywhere. Right. I see it everywhere. Mm-hmm. Opened up the newspaper yesterday and the Wall Street Journal has, which is a major newspaper in the United States, has as a major article, it says I forget the name of the article, but it was something like, you know, the different Christs or the different Jesuses, right? And so they, you know, it was Easter Sunday. So what they wanted to do was say, oh, let's write an article about the way that so many different religions understand who Jesus is. And the illustration for it was a sort of a four, you know, quartered up square where in each quarter was an image, a pretty traditional image of Jesus, his face, that was sort of done in all these different colors in each of the four squares, like Andy Warhol or something, right?
Yeah.
And there's no credit to any artist. There's no. In other words, I assume that it was probably the layout artist who made this for the newspaper and who put it in the newspaper. And I just thought, there's nowhere else for art to go, right? There's nowhere else for art to go. That Andy Warhol might be the last artist whose name we even recognize. I mean, you'd have to be probably one of the 1 or 2% of Americans at least who could name, nobody knows who artists are anymore. If you say name a popular artist from recent times, they'll all mention Andy Warhol and stop there. Like, that's the most recent artist you can think of. And so in some sense, I think that the snake has bit its own tail. And it's there's nowhere else for it to go but to consume itself, and so I don't know that we're there yet, but I in terms of like the for the renewal part yet, but there's definitely a tomb that our culture and everything has gone into, and so I say keep your eyes on the tomb door, right? Keep your eyes on the tomb door. Like, there's something coming, and it's going to be great. It's going to be glorious. There's going to be a bounce back from this meaninglessness, from this inability to recognize the depth of what we know as believers, right? From the depth of the heart of God that has entered the world, that has made holy every part of what it means to be a human, and died, and even made death a gateway to life, right?
Yeah.
That is so meaningful.
Yeah.
And here's the Wall Street Journal with these pictures of Jesus that with no irony there at all, sort of like popularized, treating Jesus as like a pop icon that you can just sort of look at and get your own meaning from and be happy with that, you know, and there's no irony there at all on their part. And I think that there's no way that can continue for much longer. So I think the best thing to do is keep your eye on the tomb door, you know, because this is where Jesus makes a comeback. This is where the King returns. This is where, and I think you're seeing some shadows of this, right? Or at least some early, you know, early adopters of what we're talking about. And this is why so many people are excited about a man like Jonathan Pageau, this is why so many people are excited about embracing older traditional religions that have a liturgical life. I think this is why some of those things are happening, that I can't help but believe we're right at the edge of it. I don't think we're there yet, but we're right at the edge of it. And I think that this generation of millennials and Gen Z, when they become the guys in charge, I think that we're going to, you know, when maturity is layered on top of, on top of all the gifts that you have for being able to embrace a sort of a postmodern worldview. Yeah. So the modernist thinkers are like, we need to be able to list it and weigh it out and show where it belongs in this great big structure of mechanical meaning. And then Generation Z, for example, and millennials are just about there too, much more comfortable with things not making sense, much more able to laugh at SpongeBob SquarePants. I can't laugh at that, but younger generations can watch that and think that it's funny because it's so ridiculous. They can embrace it as it doesn't need to mean anything. It doesn't need to be clever. It can just be funny. And so I think that there's something about being able to do that, that you add maturity on top of it. And then suddenly that your generation and Generation Z will be able to embrace the truth in a way that's probably easier than for Gen X, who needs, like, I need a scientific, or my generation needs a scientific explanation of what the resurrection is. And the younger generations won't need that as much.
Wow, that's an amazing insight, because I think it's true. It sounds to me like, in some ways, this is why I'm pushing Chesterton so much on my channel, because I really think he scratches that itch. To me, Chesterton is like a layering of maturity upon childlike wonder.
Right. That's exactly right.
Right.
Yeah. So he passed. Chesterton for me is the fool, right? So he's the one, in contradistinction to everything else that's going on. Chesterton comes out and he's the apostle of common sense in an era where that's so uncommon, right?
Yeah.
So he's the fool. But I believe these newer generations, you know, Gen Z, for example, they're all fools. Like they're all okay with not being able to make sense of everything to the mechanical level, you know?
Yeah, no, 100%. And he's like, he kind of shows you how that's, I always say the mystery of life is the sanity of life. And Gen Z, just to add on to what you're saying, and I would say millennials to a lesser extent, but still to some degree, we're much more comfortable with mystery. And maybe a Gen Z might be listening to this and say, well, I don't feel that way. But I do think in the bigger picture, there seems to be a general movement towards this accepting of things we don't understand. And you can see it all over the place, but not necessarily in the religious sense. So to keep on to Chesterton, you know, he said that there are two types of people: people who have dogmas and know that they have dogmas, like Catholics would be a good example, and then people who have dogmas but don't know they have dogmas. Right. And so you'll meet somebody who is, you know, very common these days, especially among millennials, is replacing the word God for the word universe. And everything happens for a reason, and the universe is conspiring for me. They're already pretty much there. They just are kind of, I would just say, man, that thing you're talking about, the universe, it actually is personal, and you can build a relationship with it.
Right.
It's not just some, because when I say the word universe, I picture a black night sky with stars. Like that's the, like, how personal is that? Right. You know, I can't relate to that. But okay, what if that thing is actually not just a person, but three persons in one? And maybe the reason you're a person is because that is the original person. Mm-hmm. You could think about it that way. And the reason we have families is because the origin of everything is like a family. And that to me is so compelling. And it's just taking people from that kind of deism or agnosticism, or I almost think we need a new word for it. That they're almost like on the brink of belief, but they just don't want the baggage associated with the word God, or they have family problem, or like experiential problems when they were growing up related to religion. But you know, I find that Gen Z is very hungry for religion. And I think our approach needs to be different as well. Mm-hmm. You almost need to make them more curious. You need to go deeper. Mm-hmm. You know, Bishop Barron recently had this great sermon where he said, let Christianity be weird. And I love that because now when somebody says, you know, it's kind of crazy that, and this actually happened to me recently, somebody said, it's kind of crazy that you believe that a guy rose from the dead. And I said, really? Only kind of crazy? I think it's insane.
Yeah.
I think it's nuts. And then when they hear that and they see you're sincere, they kind of conclude, okay, well, you're self-aware, you're not a lunatic. So clearly you've thought about this. Let me go deeper with you. And then you actually can have a conversation.
Right.
But if you get defensive and dare I say apologetic, you might miss out on that opportunity to kind of shock the person into curiosity. So I think that the approach also in a way needs to be different. I think we need to embrace what makes us strange. And that's as a new age guy who was really into psychedelics, the thing that I loved about Christianity was that it's weirder than anything I ever experienced on psychedelics.
Uh-huh.
Far stranger.
Because
you can be sober and read it and you don't have to
matters. It really matters. It matters in a way that I imagine, you know, the sort of, so a lot of the new age spirituality stuff in the end is often so inward looking, right? That you find people endlessly talking about themselves and their own psychological state and their own awareness of themselves and their own growth and all kind of, and there's a place for that, but it's often the whole thing for some of these guys. And so I think my hope is great for these younger generations. Now I do believe there is some maturity that's lacking.
Yeah.
And what I've noticed is that whenever young men especially get married, have kids, and they look at their child in the crib and suddenly it hits them what their purpose in life is all about. Like that awareness of it, they find themselves going back to church again. They find themselves having serious conversations about real things. And they find themselves all of a sudden wanting to put at arm's length a lot of things that we know Gen Z for, you know? So a lot of, for example, a lot of the strangeness around sexuality, for example, you know, you find that I'm finding at least that some of the guys that I've known that I taught, you know, that graduated from the high school where I was teaching in 2013 or whatever, and they've now got children. They're finding themselves saying, why? And not that they're all saying, oh, Father Brown, you were right. Everything you said was right. Not that at all. Or not, I won't say that at all, but they recognize in it something where they're like, you know what? I'm not going to just write this off because it seems like the alternative to what I definitely have come to recognize as kind of crazy, the craziness of the current generation. So that's why I say that maturity is what's lacking, but I'm very optimistic about the future that way.
Yeah. And the good thing about maturity is it tends to develop naturally over time. tends to, not always, hopefully. Yeah. But it's definitely not something that you can force on someone. I think you can force them into terrible situations. Like you can make someone go and fight in a war and that's going to quickly mature them. But assuming they don't have to experience trauma to mature, maturity does tend to develop as you undergo life's experiences. I think that this conversation we're having, I think it's going to be had for still many years to come. And I think in like 10 years from now, there's going to be Gen Zs who are much older, who are having this conversation and thinking about the movement of the times when they were younger and how maybe bizarre things seemed. And it's almost like the millennials were the end of the pendulum and the beginning of it swinging back. And now the pendulum's kind of moving back through. And I'm very curious to see what happens with the generation following Generation Z. I'm curious about that unfolding. In the long run, I remain very hopeful about it overall. So Father, thank you so much for your time today. Before we wrap things up, I just want to sincerely ask, where can people find your works? I know you have a YouTube channel, if someone wanted to explore the things you're saying and follow your work, which I highly recommend to anybody watching, to please go and subscribe to Father's channel. What should they type into YouTube? Where can they find your content at the moment?
Yeah, so if you look in YouTube under Father John Brown SJ, so just FRJOHNBROWNSJ, I should come up. That's like my channel username. And then I sort of brand everything with the response "Que viva," which is Spanish for "Long live," right? So I think you might find in the Catholic world lots of people saying "Viva Cristo Rey," and mm-hmm. so the response is "Que viva," may he live, like "Long live Christ the King," may he live. And I don't know how often I'll be putting out videos, but I'll put them out as often as people respond well to them. So there you have it.
Great, thanks so much for your time, Father, and it was lovely speaking to you. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Big pleasure. Bye.
God bless.